Welcome to Speaking Out for the Blind. I'm Brian McKellen. On a previous episode of Speaking Out for the Blind, I interviewed former New York blind governor David A. Patterson. Today, I talk with Sean Whalen. Sean Whalen is a lobbyist, and he is blind. Sean is a lobbyist for the firm Lynchpin Strategies. Lynchpin Strategies provides consulting to corporate and nonprofit clients and advances policy on education, health, and disability issues. Sean comes to the show today to share his experiences as a lobbyist with us. He also shares his journey from blindness to politics and even his new path into law. Hi, Sean.
Hey, good evening. Thanks for having me.
So, first off, before we get into this whole journey from just being young to going fresh into politics and even into law in the near future, I'd like to first ask you, what is a lobbyist?
Basically, what I do is go primarily to Capitol Hill and try and influence Congress to adopt laws and provide funding to programs that are of importance to our clients in the areas of education, health, and disability, like you mentioned. So going up on Capitol Hill, doing meetings with members of Congress and their staff, also doing meetings with the various departments of the federal government and the administration, do a lot of that as well. And another part of the job is just doing policy research about what current law is, looking at proposals for new programs and things like that, and doing a lot of research and writing for the clients in preparation to try and have bills introduced and passed.
What sort of clients do you work with?
So the biggest clients that I work with are the American Orthotic and Prosthetic Association, which is a trade group representing manufacturers, researchers, and a whole bunch of folks in the field of orthotics and prosthetics, which are essentially artificial limbs and braces and other things for individuals who've lost limbs or have other injuries. Also do a significant amount of work with the National Council of State Agencies for the Blind, which is obviously an organization of the state agencies for the blind in the various states.
Okay, we're going to talk more about these organizations in a little while. But I'd like to move on here to talk about your blindness for just a few minutes. How did you become blind?
I was actually born blind. I have Leber's congenital amaurosis.
And I heard that you had quite a journey as an uncertain high school and college student. Why don't you tell us more about this journey?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, from the time I was young, like I said, I wasn't comfortable with the thought of myself as a blind person. I hadn't really ever met many people who are blind other than my sister, who is also blind, but I kind of thought that she and I were different, and kind of the general conceptions of what blindness is didn't apply to us. You know, the few blind people I'd met kind of reinforced some of the worst stereotypes that people in society in general have about blind people. Didn't have jobs, weren't living, productive lives and fulfilling lives, and it wasn't the kind of thing I saw myself being happy doing, so I kind of concluded that I wasn't blind and that I wasn't going to be that. So I went to kind of great lengths sometimes to try and hide the fact. I mean, I remember when I was 12 or 13 years old, I went and got a paper route to make a little extra money, and my mom thought that was great, but she was like, you know, if you're going to go deliver newspapers, you're going to have to take this cane with you. And, in order to try and hide it, I'd actually go down around the corner and put my newspaper bag down and shove this cane down my pant leg and up my shirt and try and walk around with it concealed like that, which walking without being able to bend your leg is difficult, and it sounds ridiculous now, and it was ridiculous, but that's where I was at. You know, I was pretty much willing to do anything to not let it be publicly visible that I couldn't see. So, like I said, it wasn't until age 23 when I really turned that around, and it caused me a lot of difficulty in college. I wasn't comfortable in my own skin, really. I wasn't a good advocate for myself. I didn't stand up and, let the Disability Services Office know that I, for instance, preferred electronic textbooks to tapes. So I had a lot of tapes, and I did poorly in classes that I could have done better in. And I, like I said, was just not a strong advocate for myself. But if you look at my grades in college from, you know, the time before I really came to the realization that I could succeed as someone who was blind, and the time after, it's just night and day. You know, I was on academic probation at the beginning of my college career, but for the last 2.5 years of college, I earned a 3.95 GPA. So it was really two very different things, and finally coming to that level of acceptance and realizing that, you know, I was blind, having people know that was okay, and I just needed to embrace the tools I had available to me to be successful, was a big deal and made a real change in my life.
So what inspired you to follow your career dreams into politics?
So I've always been kind of interested in politics. My grandmother, who I always have been and still am very close with, is a big-time political junkie, and I used to watch a lot of C-SPAN and just be really interested in, you know, politics and public policy. I guess what really solidified it for me as something that I thought I could do or wanted to do was actually getting involved with advocacy efforts on behalf of blind people and issues related to blindness. So I actually had opportunities to go to Washington, D.C. and meet with legislators about issues impacting blind people. For instance, as a college student, access to electronic textbooks and things like that. And just going and seeing that you could have an impact like that really hit home for me. And not only that, also seeing that, you know, the people who were up on Capitol Hill doing these jobs were just people like me, and I said, you know, I can see myself doing this, and it really made it concrete and gave me something to shoot for. So in the course of one of those meetings, I met with Congressman Ron Kind from Wisconsin, my home state, and kind of expressed to him my interest in an internship, and he said, you know, oh, that'd be great, talk to my intern coordinator. And sometime later, I was in his office as an intern, and that's what got me out here to the East Coast, got me to D.C., and you know, through that internship, I was, you know, working for free, so obviously looking for paid work, and finally came upon this opportunity with Lynchpin Strategies and started doing lobbying work. So initially I was looking for a job on Capitol Hill as a legislative staffer, but the opportunity to come to Lynchpin and really work on a variety of issues and kind of push an agenda was really appealing to me, and I've learned a lot about public policy and politics through my experience here as a lobbyist and policy associate with Lynchpin.
So when you worked with Congressman Kind, how was that experience? Did you help him pass any legislation? Did you help deliver the mail? How was the experience?
Yeah, I mean, overall it was a really positive experience. You know, Ron, the congressman, was really a good guy from the time I met him, and you know, he was really positive about the situation, and everyone in the office, really, for the most part. I didn't feel like the expectations for me were set artificially low. There were, you know, certainly jobs that I didn't do. Sorting the mail, you know, is something that, you know, could you do it with a scanner or a reader and things like that? Yeah, you could, but is it really an efficient use of your time as someone who's blind? Probably not, I feel. So, you know, there's, at the same time, there's thousands of emails that needed sorting, and I did that, and did emails, answered phones, did research for the legislative assistants when they needed something. You know, a lot of drafting of letters to constituents or drafting floor statements for the congressman to deliver or submit to the record. So, you know, really as an intern, obviously, I wasn't highly involved with policy decisions or doing super meaningful work on having legislation passed, but just being around that and seeing it all happening was really impactful to me. I was actually up in the congressman's office during the whole financial crisis of 2008, and when the you know, the troubled asset relief program, the TARP, basically the bank bailout, was passed, and just seeing all that go down, it was really kind of it was a terrible time for the country in a lot of ways, but it was very kind of interesting to see the Congress operating in that crisis mode and kind of the critical mass of public opinion that was flowing in from constituents about that issue. So it was certainly an eventful time to be up there, and that is the biggest piece of legislation I saw the House pass in my time up on the Hill, but again, you know, I certainly wasn't involved in the policy aspect of it.
Did the internship lead to your current position at Linchpin Strategies, or did you look online to find that the position was open, or how did you get involved with them?
I actually got involved just through an email forward that somebody had seen on a list looking for, initially I started as an intern with Linchpin, and was being paid a small stipend, but it certainly wasn't a full-time salary like I have now, you know, and it was a email posting that was on a list, and I just replied by email to my boss, now Katrina, who had posted it, and we ended up speaking on the phone and got along really well and essentially was offered the position. So came in and was doing some work on the Randolph-Shepard Act, and eventually after several months of that, you know, she and I got along really well, and she was pleased with the work I was doing, and the offer to have this become, basically have me contract with the firm to provide services to additional clients, and the Randolph-Shepard clients I was working with on a full-time basis came along, so I've been doing that ever since.
Yeah, speaking of the Randolph-Shepard Act, I was reading online you had sent out a call to action letter to one of the clients that you worked with, which was indeed the NCSAB, which you had mentioned earlier. And they stand for the National Council of State Agencies for the Blind. And you were working with the organization to preserve the entrepreneurial opportunities for the Randolph-Shepard vendors. So could you tell our audience, for those that may or may not know, what's Randolph-Shepard, and how did this issue of preserving entrepreneurial opportunities just come about?
Sure. So the Randolph-Shepard program is a federal program. There's actually a state-level counterpart in 49 of the 50 states that works in much the same way. But it's a program that gives a priority in getting permits or contracting for vending machines or food service like snack bars or cafeterias to businesses that are managed by people who are blind. And the state agencies have a role in administering the program. The state agencies actually are responsible for holding the contracts or permits and assigning them to licensed blind vendors in the program. So it's a really unique federal program in its creation of kind of entrepreneurial and managerial opportunities for people who are blind. It's different than some, you know, employment programs for blind people where it's a program to get you a job. This is a program to allow blind individuals to run and manage businesses and have entrepreneurial opportunities like that. So there are a lot of issues that we've worked on related to Randolph-Shepard. One of the biggest recently was this amendment that Senator Rob Portman from Ohio had proposed to the Surface Transportation Reauthorization Bill last summer, which is basically a bill that authorizes funding for highways and other modes of transportation, but the highway portion is what was of interest to us because there are several hundred Randolph-Shepard entrepreneurs and vendors across the country who run businesses running vending machines on rest stops on federal interstate highways. So the proposal was to allow commercial development and privatization on these rest areas, for instance, to open the way for, you know, Subway or McDonald's or 7-Eleven to set up shop on what is essentially government property. So that amendment, obviously, if there's a McDonald's or a 7-Eleven, the vending machine business you're running is going to see significant reductions in revenue, and to the point where the vast majority of the businesses just wouldn't have been viable and those opportunities would have been eliminated. So Linchpin, working with NCSAB, kind of led the charge in opposition to this amendment, and actually we had it defeated. I believe the final vote was 86 to 12. It went down. So that was a big one. And we also just do a lot of work with, you know, the various state agencies. If they're having trouble with compliance with the act from a federal agency, or, you know, other issues that impact the Randall Shepard Vending Program crop up from time to time in different legislation, and we address those to make sure that the priority for food service is maintained. And I mean, these are really a broad range of operations. You have people who run vending machines on rest areas, like I said, or you know, snack bars, little food stands, but it goes all the way up to really enormous troop dining contracts at military installations where you have blind managers managing, you know, contracts worth hundreds of millions of dollars, and those create really good opportunities for driven, business-minded blind individuals to, you know, benefit from a real entrepreneurial opportunity.
So now we're going to move on, and we're going to talk more about your vision and how it works within your job for a few minutes. So what accessible technology or assistance do you use on your job as a lobbyist?
I use screen readers. I mean, just for context, I have, you know, next to no vision. I have scarcely, you know, I'm functionally blind. I don't have any usable vision. So everything I do pretty much is non-visual. So I use JAWS for Windows, occasionally use other screen readers as needed, but that's certainly my primary, being not just proficient, but really a strong user of that enables me to do a lot of what I do and do it efficiently and quickly. I think that's a really important skill set for me, is being strong as a screen reader. I also use, a note taker in my instance of PathMate to take notes in meetings and refer to things quickly in Braille if I need to. I don't read Braille particularly quickly because I didn't learn until I was like 24 years old. Another issue, my school never really taught me to read Braille, and I wasn't totally interested in learning because I was trying not to be blind, so that's another setback. But still, even learning as an adult is something that comes in handy and is very useful in referring to notes in an office where we're having a meeting if I don't want to, you know, boot up a laptop or have earbuds in my ears. So, screen reader, Braille, I mean, I'm a cane user. Strong O&M skills, I think, are important. I need to get myself around Capitol Hill, find the offices where I need to meet, you know. And, I mean, it's just, you know, important to obviously be able to get yourself where you need to go, and I need to be places on time and need to appear competent and like I'm able to get myself around. So use a cane, and, you know, other than that, that's really the majority of it. I mean, from time to time, I'll employ the services of a reader to deal with something if it's an occasional, you know, scan of a document with handwriting on it or something. But I can think of maybe two or three instances in the 4 years that I've been doing this when I've actually needed to do that. So for the most part, it's really just about technology, the Braille is useful, and, you know, the O&M skills are huge.
How do you use all those skills to get to and from work and go meet with your clients?
Sure. So, I mean, the thing about Washington, D.C. is the transportation is excellent. So, we have an office downtown near the Senate office buildings, and I can, you know, just leave my home, walk to the Metro, which is the subway system here in D.C., and take that down to Union Station, walk over to the office, walk over to the Senate, walk over to the House side, wherever I need to be. So it's pretty easy as far as transportation goes. From time to time, there will be conferences and things. You know, I travel to Nashville, Philadelphia, Chicago for different things. And, you know, there it becomes important just to have solid O&M skills, you know, cane, dog, whatever your mobility tool of choice is. In my instance, a cane, being good and proficient with it, and, you know, being able to find my way around a new hotel to the meeting rooms and things like that. So just a lot of the same basic O&M skills that I think most people are familiar with, but to me it's just about constantly building and expanding on that skill set by, you know, sometimes getting outside your comfort zone and going out, and if you get lost somewhere, realizing it's not the end of the world, you will find yourself. And the only way you really learn is by trying new things. So that's a big part of what I do.
So I heard that you spoke at a special lunch at the Lions Center for the Blind in Oakland, California. And I heard that you just were recently admitted to law school for the fall of 2013. And I heard that it was one sizable struggle to just fight and win the admission. Tell our audience about the steps, just of how you got accepted into law school.
Okay, yeah. So, just for clarification, I actually, knock on wood, will be accepted, but haven't yet. I just have filled out my applications and I'm waiting to hear back from, I've applied to about 10 schools and I'm waiting to hear back in the next, some as early as next week and some probably more in the April to May timeframe. But, the issue I had was with accommodations on the LSAT, which is a standardized test that anyone interested in attending law school in the United States or Canada has to take. And basically, when I applied for accommodations, there was no option to take the test using an electronic format, a screen reader. They offered Braille, which, you know, I read Braille at probably 60 words a minute. That's just not efficient, and it's a time test, and there's no way I could do that. They offered large print, which is not an option for me, or they offered having a human reader read the test to you, which is great if that works for you and that's what you're accustomed to and that's what you want to do. I have no problem with that, but that is not what works for me. I, you know, like I said, use readers very sparingly, occasionally to, you know, sort things or read handwriting or stuff like that, but I don't use readers to read books or articles or briefs, memos, legislation, anything like that that requires real comprehension. So I, along with my application, you know, wrote an addendum and a letter saying I'd really like to take this on a computer using a screen reader in an electronic format. I have used electronic files and a computer to do all my reading through the majority of high school, all of college, and my entire professional life thus far. And I just told them I think that that would really be the most, you know, fair way and the way that would give the most accurate assessment of my capabilities on what the test is actually supposed to test. So they got back to me, the Law School Admissions Council, and said, who is it? That's the body that administers the LSAT, got back to me and said that that wasn't an option, they didn't offer it, and sorry, I could choose one of what they had offered. And I knew that wasn't going to work for me. I actually knew of other individuals who had in the past been allowed to take the test on a computer using JAWS, but they also had kind of a similar fight to what I had on my hands. But I told them, you know, I know you've done this. I know you've made it available to other people. And I wrote a appeal letter. That was denied. I then went and enlisted the assistance of an attorney who helped me write a second appeal letter and accompanied it with a letter, you know, basically outlining what we felt was their legal obligation to provide the accommodation. Again, they denied that, but eventually, as we were considering taking legal action and making, you know, making a legal issue out of it, they, you know, turned around on that and said, okay, we will let you do this, and they did. And I will say, once they agreed to let me do it, they did an excellent job of, you know, marking it up in HTML and making it very navigable and usable by a screen reader. And I did very well on the test. And I know had I been taking it with someone reading it to me, I would not have scored as well. I'd taken practice tests both ways. And the difference between my best score on a practice test with a reader and my best score on a practice test using a computer was, I believe, 6 points. And the test is scored between 120 and 180. So there's only, you know, a 60-point range. So 6 points is a big deal. And it really made a huge difference. So it was about an 18-month process of going through all the appeals and finally getting my way. But I did, and like I said, I did well. I'm glad that I took the time, you know, to make the issue out of it, and everything worked out. But obviously, you know, you'd hope that as someone who's blind, you wouldn't have to go through that extra delay and jump through those extra hoops just to really essentially get a fair shot on the test. So that was the situation.
So if you get that acceptance letter, which law school do you think you're going to go to? And when what kind of law do you want to study?
So if I had my if I got acceptance letters from every school I applied to and I had my pick, I would either go to Harvard or Stanford. I am not sure. I would also, I think, really enjoy going to Northwestern in Chicago because I am from the Midwest. But those are three that I think have the highest appeal to me. But I'd be really actually quite thrilled to get into any of the schools I applied to. As far as what kind of law I want to practice, I am honestly not totally sure on that. I think a lot of people going into law school don't know exactly where they want to specialize, and you, to some degree, figure it out along the way. I know that education and education law has a big appeal to me. Also, just using the law degree in more of a political and policy capacity is something that I find really appealing. I want to do politics eventually. I want to help make public policy, I think. In the meantime, in law school, I would hope to kind of use my summers to have a variety of experiences. I'd like to take a summer trying to do the corporate thing and see what that's like, but also, spend maybe another summer somewhere in the federal government, in the Department of Education or Department of Justice, something like that. So these are just some thoughts about where I'm at on that. I guess one thing I would say is, whether it be through actually practicing law or making policy or doing more advocacy work like I do now, it's important to me to do two things. One, have disability issues and blindness issues always kind of be a part of my portfolio and be something I work on because there's something that apply to me personally, and I think I'm, more persuasive on because I have life experience. But also, it's extremely important to me to not get pigeonholed into that and to be able to be successful in areas outside of disability, be it education, be it economics and financial stuff, which are both interests of mine. I think it's really important to me to be able to have kind of a broader portfolio and not deal only with disability issues. One, because, education, economic opportunity are things that I really care a lot about. And two, because I think being successful in a field not related to disability as someone with a disability can go a long way towards shaping public opinion and, making people reevaluate what they think people who are blind or have other kinds of disabilities can contribute to the discourse and the dialogue. So, in a lot of ways, doing that kind of work, I think also serves to further the cause of, disability rights and equality.
So what do you encourage the blind and visually impaired to do if they want to go into any careers in politics or law? What would you tell them?
If you want to do law, I'd say that, obviously the LSAT is the first place to start, and encourage you to get the accommodations you need on it. If you want to get into the law as someone who's blind, I'd suggest seeking out someone else who's blind who's already doing it. I know some of the first successful blind people I met were lawyers, and that's what made me realize, hey, yeah, I can do this. So a lot of times talking to someone who's been there before you and knows what some of the potential barriers you're going to face are, and more importantly knows, the ways to get around those barriers and solutions to some of the problems, I think that's really big. And if you just want to get into politics in general, there's a ton of ways to do that. If there's issues in particular that someone is interested in, either inside or outside of the blindness or disability field, go try and volunteer or intern with a nonprofit who works on those issues. Or if you're interested in, legislating, do what I did and try and go intern for your home state senators or your local congressman, or even, in your state legislature, there's opportunities there. So,
okay, well, Sean, our listeners may indeed just want to work with you on Capitol Hill after hearing your story of being triumphant in the political world and, indeed, conquering the challenges of blindness. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
That's all for this edition of Speaking Out for the Blind. Thanks for listening. And remember to speak out.
You're listening to American Council for the Blind Radio.
By the blind, for the world.